First, I've got an apology to make. I've been quite busy, so I haven't really been doing my email as assiduously as I should have been. So I haven't responded to various requests for tutorials. However, there is now a Doodle poll online. And I don't know, there's about 40 slots. Each slot will take up to two groups. So we should be able to get it scheduled reasonably quickly. If you're ready to do it, yeah. The other thing that slightly worried me was, how many of you are finding it's taking you too long? Everybody, my God. Okay, so you must be testing, okay, because if you remember at the very beginning of the tutorial, at the very beginning of the practical, it says you have a budget. Yeah, try and stay inside it. Yeah. How much long? How much too long? So let's see. Okay, very, very, very long. Yeah, so okay, so I'll count up and let's see. So who's taking more than 30 hours? Wow, more than 40 hours? One or two people, yeah. Are you nearly finished, 40-hour people? No. My God. Okay. Because I did everything I could to try to make this a reasonable practical. Yeah. Because they had to do, I mean, basically, more or less, this was almost an individual practical. I mean, I added a couple of little things to it, yeah, and changed it around a bit. But what I thought was spreading, are people finding the group difficult to manage? Is that a problem? Is the fact it's, I mean, if it were, I mean, to some extent, I know there's at least one person who's just doing it on his own, yeah, who has an interest in testing, you know, but, okay, so that's worrying. I don't know quite what to do about that. Because it's very difficult to work out what to do that's fair now, isn't it? If you're finding that it's really affecting your ability to submit other things, yeah, then what I would like you to do is to submit the other things and to tell me how long it's taken you when you you know, as part of the report, yeah, to get to the point that you've got to. So I think that if you're beyond 30 hours, let's say, yeah, and you have other pressing things to do and trying to finish software testing is interfering with that, then what I'd like you to do is just to say, look, I didn't finish this for the following reason, yeah, because it was taking me so long, and do your other bits of work, yeah, because if it really is taking that much longer than I estimated, then I've horribly underestimated how long it would take you, yeah? So, and that's bad, that's terrible, because I really thought it would only take you, I mean, because sort of 80 or 100 hours of effort is quite, you know, it's a fair amount of effort. But I guess that you're finding quite a lot of it is just getting taken up with coordination effort in the groups. Is that right? Because it seems like there's quite a lot of problems around people not showing up. The other thing I've done, and this went out in the email I sent out this morning, is that if you are, it's just to confirm something that I've been telling people who've got small groups. If you have got a group of three or fewer, then only do, you know, if you've got a group of size n, yeah, only do n of the tasks. Yeah. So if you've got a group of size 3, just do 3 of the group tasks and 3 of the other tasks. If it's 2 of the tasks, 2 of the other tasks. Yeah, because then I think it's about fair, because the size of the tasks is just about, yeah. Okay, whereas if you've got 4 or above, then you should be able to do the whole thing. I would have thought in 100 hours, but, or 80 hours, but. Okay, so I have to adjust it, and I don't know quite what to do, but I'll try to take that into account if you tell me that you're overrunning and it's affecting your other work. Because you should have had enough time to have 20 hours from when it was issued until the deadline without it interfering too much in other work. And I'm sorry that it's taken so long. Okay. So, yeah?
Only four people in the group.
Uh-huh.
There's 5 individual tasks, you just not do all not do one of them. Yeah, it says that in the handout. Yeah. If there are only four people in the group, it should be four of, because each person does one individual task. I don't want the five. The reason there are five individual tasks is that the idea is the max group size is five. Yeah, so there should be five individual. Yeah, so you can omit one. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, everybody happy about that? Any other questions?
Right, the other thing I should say is that I am not going to be here next week, so you will be completing the practical. Yeah, I have got somebody else who's going to do my tutorials for me. I'm going to do some of them with him, so he'll be well briefed, and everything should be fine. Actually, I have a weekly tutor meeting with the tutors, actually sometimes a couple of times a week, and what they're telling me is they're getting better and better at the tutorials. Yeah, so they're, because what they do is they see the problems from the previous time. Yeah, so each time, so there's probably an optimal time at which the tutors are most experienced and they haven't gotten completely bored. Yeah, so there's probably some kind of optimal point at which you should pick your tutorial to operate. Anyway, the other thing is there is a hand in for next week. I'm really keen not to delay it, because if I delay it, all that will happen is software testing will start to bang into all the other things that you've got at the end of semester. And if we have it next week as a deadline, then it should be clear of pretty much everything else that you're likely to have to submit. Yeah? So that's why it's timed the way it is. So there won't be lectures next week. I'll put that up on the website. We'll finish off the following week. What that will mean is that you've got a little bit more time to finish your practical work. But all the tutors will be here next week, and I'll be in Skype and email contact if anybody's got anything desperate they want to talk about. And I can talk to the tutors as well, so it shouldn't be too bad. I'm in China, yeah, so that means just about when I stop working, you guys will start working, so I can always work through if necessary. Okay, that's enough of that. So here we are, integration testing. So we're kind of moving on. We've been talking quite a lot about kind of low-level stuff, at unit level. And now we're going on to talk about the kind of higher levels. You know, so if you think about the V diagram that we had at the beginning, you know, you've got define the system test, yeah, define the integration test, define the unit tests, code, unit test, integration test, system test. So that's the kind of... that's the kind of classical software engineering approach to this. And of course, in some sense, inside any methodology, there are usually those kinds of things. It's just, it depends on how small the unit of delivery is each time. But in a sense, you have that in every single methodology. It just depends on the scale and the amount of trouble you're going to give yourself by leaving testing late. Okay, so... unit testing, it's getting a hold of something and trying to push it very hard. And you probably have to build a lot of scaffolding around it, you know, so you know that you have this build-up phase and then the tear-down phase when you write JUnits. And you may need lots of stub code around and about to take the place of functions or objects. And unit test depends on having a sort of specification for the code units if you're doing black box, but then if you're doing white box testing, it doesn't. And unit tests expend effort on looking at functionality that's never exercised. I mean, it's kind of interesting when you look at most bits of code, when you actually use them in context. I mean, particularly, I mean, it depends a little bit on exactly the kind of environment that you're in, but a lot of code will never be exercised in the environment that the thing is being used in. So, for example, it's quite often the case that there's a lot of testing inside a unit for malformed input or stuff that doesn't make sense because you're trying to make the code robust. But actually, in the environment it gets used, yeah, you know that it will always be called with sensible parameters, and so that code never ever gets used. Yeah, so there are those kinds of trade-offs. Yeah. So, what we're talking about integration testing is we're interested in looking at how do we pull things together? How do we put stuff together? So here on the left-hand side, you've got kind of integration test approach, and on the right-hand side, you've got kind of unit testing approach. Yeah? Because in some sense, you're looking at class A and you're saying, well, how does it interact with all of this other stuff? And these things here kind of implicitly get a test. And this is the kind of thing that you're looking at in task three, where you're saying, well, how much of the class under test can I get coverage of? Because I'm interested in seeing how many calls there are, how many of the method calls I can cover. So integration or incremental test aims to reduce the need for the scaffolding by using actual code modules as they're developed, and they provide the scaffolding for testing, and they pull the things together as you go. And an integration or incremental test provides a means for carrying out the unit test, but at the same time it tests the integration of the system across the module boundaries. And there's a variety of different ways that you can do that, and we'll come back and talk about that. And here we're going to talk a little bit about how do software errors arise and where do they come? Because when we start talking about integration testing, then what we do is we start thinking about what the likely ways are that these things arise and what sort of things happen. And in particular, you know, we can think about this at kind of mission critical sorts of software errors, because that's where this kind of stuff tends to be studied. So in particular, people worry a lot about systems where your life depends on the software. So I guess main places that is, again, most people fly, most aircraft have got a lot of code in them. I think the Airbus A340 has got about 3.5 million lines of code in the avionics system. So that's not in, you know, there's probably a billion lines of code in the entertainment system that says you can watch as many movies as you like as you fly from A to B, but that's not safety critical. Well, you hope it isn't anyway. Well, it's really, actually, that's a really interesting issue. So once upon a time, yeah, people who built aircraft were really all mechanical and electrical engineers. Yeah, and so what they did was they had a separate computer that did one thing, and then they had another computer that did another thing, and then they had another computer that did another thing, and basically when you press the button on the call button on your seat, then that was on a completely different bus, different wires, had absolutely nothing to do with the avionics software, yeah, so there couldn't possibly be any interaction because they were physically separated. But of course there's lots of pressure on weight, yeah, and there's pressure on cost and so on and so on. So now what you tend to find is that actually lots of stuff that used to sit on different computers sits on the same one. And then there's a bunch of software that makes sure that these things can't interfere with one another. Yeah. Now, rest assured that doesn't include the entertainment system. That stuff is still completely separate. But for quite a lot of the critical functions on things like an aircraft, then you do get sharing of processors, because if you're looking at trying to produce a high availability system, then you'll have something like a triplicated processor arrangement where you've got a bunch of processors and then they vote at the end to see that they agree and so on. And you don't necessarily want to duplicate that for lots of different subsystems. So what they do is they pull it together, they use the same hardware, and then they have software sitting on the top to say that the stuff that's doing the navigation is not going to interfere with the stuff that does the power control, for example. Yeah. Although still there are lots of subcomputers inside of that, but at least for the main systems, they will typically share some hardware these days. So people worry a lot about those kind of things. And even if you look now, I mean, most cars that you drive have actually got rather a lot of software in them. And there you saw a very interesting thing, because for a while, motor manufacturers outsourced their software. And the reason for that was they wanted to de-risk their business from software errors. So they got some independent company to do the software. But then they realized that nearly all of the behavioral characteristics of the car were being defined in the software, so they pulled it all back in again, and it became a much bigger part of their business. But still, in cars now, that you tend to have the same kind of thing. You have this thing where there's probably two or three different main in-car bus systems that run the data, and then you have a critical bus that runs the time-critical stuff, that runs the engine management, and probably the safety indicators and so on around the car. And then you have some lower-level stuff that does things like the entertainment, taking the windows up and down and so on. But this is getting a bit anecdotal, but the interesting thing is they put a huge amount of effort into making it seem as though things are still connected up by bits of wire. Yeah. So they'll spend a very long time making sure that when you press one of those little buttons down, you know, the door locking buttons, they're not physically connected in any way. Yeah, it all goes back to a computer and then they all click down together. You know that thing? Making sure that they're simultaneous enough is actually quite difficult. Yeah, and they'll spend quite a long time just making sure that when you press down that button, all the other ones go down at the same time. Yeah, because, and of course, it'd be much easier for them if they didn't do that, but then everybody wouldn't like their cars as much, so they kind of, because they wouldn't feel like those things were connected to anything. And, you know, more and more they're working on, you know, trying to do that kind of thing and make it feel as though you still have a mechanical connection to the wheels and stuff like that. You know, so kind of anyway, that's enough of that. So one particularly interesting area is NASA, yeah, because of course they don't typically have, I mean they have had mission, they have had safety critical missions in the sense that if things went wrong, somebody would die, you know, so, and people have died in space programs. But the other, their other area of business is kind of interplanetary stuff. And there you have an interesting situation because it's terribly mission critical, because if the software goes wrong, then basically you kind of lose the spacecraft. Yeah. I mean, there's lots of backup, you know, so the, if you lose communication with the spacecraft, then what it will do is it hangs around waiting for a message, and then a timer will run out somewhere, and then it starts to look for the sun, and then it knows where the Earth is relative to the sun, and it points its antenna in the right direction just in case it's lost. I mean, there's loads and loads of kind of backup in order to make sure this thing can then talk back to Earth. But the other interesting thing about it is that the software runs for a very, very long time. I don't know when, do you know, it's a US spacecraft called Voyager, yeah? I don't know when it was launched. I think it was launched in the early 70s. And it just went, sort of about 5 or 6 years ago, it just went through the heliopause, yeah, where the solar wind from the sun is no longer detectable. So it's, you know, out beyond Pluto, yeah, and out beyond the Oort cloud or whatever, you know, the stuff that's around the solar system. So it's kind of out beyond that, yeah. And they actually were able to communicate with these things till they got very, very far out. So you had this thing where you had this software that was running for something like 20 or 30 years, yeah. And you could actually see long run where faults come up. Yeah. So Robin Lutz did all of this work on looking at two long-lived interplanetary space missions, yeah, Voyager and Galileo, and did an analysis of the sorts of errors that came up. So here's the top line. So over the lifetime, and here we're talking about, you know, 20, 30 years. The other interesting thing about this is, in a sense, the program only ever has to run once, yeah? Because what these things do is they encounter various planets as they go out. And in a sense, they're set up to do something. And they can test it before they actually let the spacecraft do it. You know, so if you're going to navigate close to some moon of Jupiter or something like that and get a little bit of slingshot from it, then you can do the simulation and run the actual code on the version of the stuff that you've got on the ground and see whether it works or not. So you can detect safety critical errors before they happen, and you've got time to work on it. And actually, then you can upload the fix that actually will mean that it doesn't crash into the planet. So here they are. So this is, I wouldn't say these were safety related. I'd say they're mission critical. Yeah, so the dark blue are mission critical faults. The light blue are mission critical faults, and the dark blue are non-mission critical faults. And you can see that actually, although they're something like 10 or 15 years apart, the programming methodology didn't get terribly much better, except the code in Voyager is probably quite a lot smaller than the code in Galileo, because Galileo's got bigger computers in it, because it was
something that was launched something like 10 or 15 years later.
And one other thing to say here is that the Voyager had more mission critical faults in it than non-critical faults. And if you look at the total, you know, it's around 100 faults over the lifetime of the software. So, I mean, that's pretty good going, actually. And the goal is trying to make the system safe or secure by removing these mission critical errors. Yeah. And then the thing is finding the source of the problem. And they use this kind of, Lutz's methodology is to look at this kind of stuff. So it's actually try and do root cause analysis. And they use this Nakajo and Kume's classification scheme for leading backward in time from a software error to the analysis of root cause. So if you get an error, so you document your error, you try and find the human error, and then you try and identify the process flaws that led to the human error. Because, you know, if it's clear that there is a human error, then ideally in these kind of things that are trying to produce high reliability software, there should be something in the process that catches common human error. Yeah. So if there's a routine thing that means that you'll get some sort of error in the final software, then what you should be able to do is to evolve the development process so that it avoids that some way or another, or at least reduces the probability of that occurring. Okay, so here, if we look at different kinds of faults that they've got. So they really identified three different kinds of things. So they're internal faults, and those are things like syntax errors and so on. And those are things that are usually just caught in the development process. And usually they won't be counted as errors in some sense. You know, so they're caught beforehand. And then the other two classes that she looked at were interface faults, yeah, and that's incorrect interaction with other system components. So that was 36% of the faults in Voyager and 19% of the faults in Galileo. And actually, in Voyager, it was quite often that the software guys didn't understand how some piece of hardware was going to interact with them. Yeah, so that they were writing a piece of software. They expected this piece of hardware to have some kind of behavior when they poked it with various signals, and actually it turned out that they didn't have the right model for how the thing was going to behave. Yeah. So that's these kind of things here. And then functional faults, so that's incorrect behavior by programs, that's about 50% of the functional faults. And then conditional faults, so that was 73% of the safety-related errors, and that's values are critical for decision making, so it's triggering the right time and triggering the right response at the right time. And then operating faults, it's omission of operation or failure to perform tasks. Yeah, so these are basically the three different categories here. But if you look, 73% of safety related errors were conditional faults. Yeah, so that's where actually you need testing to discover, or it's quite possible to test and not discover them, because it's only for particular sets of values that the behavior is going to be wrong. Okay, so that's the proportions there. And then here, this is really what the human error looks like. So this is the contribution to, if you remember here we have, you know, documented software error, human error, process flaws. So this is trying to track back. So here's the proportion of documented errors. Here's the human error. So it's coding or editing errors is one contribution. Communication errors between the teams. So quite often misunderstanding hardware interface specs or the other team's software interface specs. Errors in deploying requirements, so that's problems with implementing the requirements to the design. Errors in recognizing requirements, so that's misunderstanding specs or the problem domain. And communication errors inside a team, yeah, so that's misunderstanding within software interface. And I think in the paper, then they've got some kind of proportion for these things, yeah, looking at these. But actually, they were fairly balanced actually between these things. So this one is something that you should be able to deal with fairly easily. But all of the rest, if you look at these two, for example, then typically they have to do with communication between different teams or different skills. And then the things at the bottom has to do with trying to understand what the requirement means. Yeah, so actually understanding what it is that you're supposed to be doing. And recognizing whether something is a requirement or not. So this is kind of lack of clarity in the explanation of what's supposed to happen. And here's what we're seeing as not. This is the flaws that happened in the process. Yeah. So here, this is the what was it that led us to get these kind of human errors? And here, inadequate interface specifications. So very often, you know, if you look between kind of digital world and the hardware world, if you've got an analog device, yeah, then typically what you need to do is you actually need to hold a value on the output, yeah. But the thing is that if you look at software guys, they quite often they think about transferring data from A to B, yeah. So they only hold a value for a short while, that should be recognized by the thing, and then it works the way it's supposed to work, yeah. So quite often you'll get that kind of that dissonance between hardware people working on analog devices that do kind of continuous things, and then software people who think about sending a message, who have a kind of message passing model. You quite often find that when the hardware people write their thing, they have an assumption that this is an analog device, it behaves this way. And they never say that. Yeah, they just think it'd be stupid for it to behave any other way. Whereas the software people think, well, of course it should behave this way. I mean, I don't suppose, do you have any of those kind of things? SDP people, have you found, yeah, you found that all the time in the robot, of course, yeah? Yeah, that when you're trying to drive the motors, yeah, they're analog devices, yeah? So they have a particular requirement. Mm-hmm. And you look at the interface and it seems like it's telling you one thing, but then actually when you try and run it from a piece of software, it doesn't behave exactly the way you expect. So that kind of thing is the sort of thing that happens all the time in these space things. Incomplete documentation. Actually, I suppose all of these things are things you'll have experienced in SDP, yeah? So incomplete or inaccessible in one way or another, yeah? So you can't actually find the documentation that you need. Yeah, I really wish I knew what this interface did. And then an inadequate design process. So that's something which doesn't make sure that you meet the specification, which may be wrong anyway. And then requirements not identified or understood. So this is a very critical one here, yeah, because actually you find lots of the classic kind of big scale software errors have to do with requirements not identified or understood, yeah. So it's not realizing that actually, let's say the Ariane 5 launcher will acquire a much higher horizontal velocity than the old one, so the old guidance system is not going to work in the new context. Yeah. And then inadequate communication, and then inadequate code inspection and testing methods. What they found when they did this was that actually NASA have got these great big books. Yeah, if you go online, you'll find they have big documented software process development manuals. And when they got this result, they kind of introduced testing. So actually they added extra testing throughout all of the phases, yeah, and they put extra test gates between the phases, yeah, in order to check for these kind of things, in order to try to fix quite a lot of these issues. And then they flirted for a while with this thing called faster, cheaper, better. Yeah, And the thing is, never believe anybody when they tell you that you can do more for less. Yeah. So it's especially not if you're somebody like NASA who's already trying quite hard anyway. Yeah. So it's so here we are. So let's look. This is the kind of summary of what happened with the interface faults and what happened with the functional faults. Yeah. So if we look at here, safety-related interface faults, then communication errors between teams, 93% of the faults came from that on Voyager, 72% in Galileo. Misunderstanding other teams' software specs and misunderstanding hardware specs. But if you look, then something like, you know, nearly everything on Voyager came because the one team didn't understand what the other team was doing in terms of interfaces. So that's what happened in human errors. And then the process flaws, inadequate interface specification, and inadequate communication by software and hardware development. So they didn't document the interface specifications. Then if we look at the functional faults, then the vast bulk of this came from errors in recognizing requirements. So that's either omitted or not understanding requirements. Yeah? And here, really, there are two things: requirements not identified and incomplete documentation. And this stuff led to a huge development in requirements management stuff. Yeah. So, for example, there was a big software tool called Doors that was just a requirements management system, and they had a whole team inside Doors, the Doors guys, who just supplied Boeing with their version of it. Yeah. So they had their own tailor-made version of their requirements management system that, I don't know, they paid vast amounts of money for each year, just in order to try and handle this kind of stuff. Yeah, this problem resulting from inadequate requirements. And of course, the requirement issue is a huge thing. I looked at, a few years back, I looked at the change in specification between one engine controller and another engine controller for jet engine. Yeah, and it was the big jet engine. And there were about, I think, 4,000 requirement changes. And that's just going from, you know, one version to the next version up in terms in the power range. Yeah. Because these documents are extremely detailed. You know, they're pretty long, yeah, you know, maybe several hundred pages. And when you go through and you look at the numbers of changes that you get huge numbers of changes. And you find through the development process that actually you need to refine the requirement. Because as you try to integrate, I mean, in this case, the engine controller with the engine, then you find that actually you don't understand the physical characteristics of the engine, and then you have to go back and change the specification, and then the software has to get redeveloped and so on. So these things about requirement management are probably the primary thing that people try to work on if you're looking at trying to control error throughout systems. So here's a little diagram. Yeah. So what are the important things? Yeah. Try to think about being defensive in design, even if that means that you add quite a lot of extra code that never gets used. Yeah, so you should think about having contracts on your classes so that you know what the relationships are between the local variables and what you can expect to produce as a result when you get a method call. People are quite keen on using formal specification techniques as well as natural language software requirement specifications. So, and that led to, you know, so for some things we've got quite good formal specification techniques. So for very many things you can use a finite state machine, and that'll give you quite a big plus.
And then promote informal communication amongst teams. So what you should try and do is get people to speak to one another. And then as early as you can, you should identify the dinosaurs. Yeah, so you kind of identify safety critical hazards early in requirements analysis. And then you think about hardware and software, because actually the hardware-software interface in anything that's embedded is the most problematic thing. And then also you think about communication and you think about managing the requirement. How many of you found that in, I mean, I'm talking to third years here, how many of you found that in SDP, that there's been real problems in the communication between, let's say, vision and planning, or planning and communicating with the robot, or, yeah? So, again, even in a team of 10 working on something that's only going to take you 10 weeks, you actually see all of these problems coming up. Maybe I should have given this lecture earlier. Do you think that would have been a good idea? So how to approach integration testing. And really, I mean, this is, I'm going to go through this fairly fast because it's, I think it's a bit of motherhood and apple pie, actually. So in any system, we've got a dependency graph. And often this is hierarchical. I don't believe this for a moment, actually. Most of the time, it's not hierarchical. Most of the time, it's actually much more of a mess. But when you're thinking about doing integration testing, generally what you do is you break some of the dependency loops and just don't worry about them for a bit, yeah, so you can actually test the thing. So that typically what you do is you say, okay, I'm going to ignore some of the dependencies, and then what I do is I get something that looks like a directed acyclic graph, yeah, where I don't have any loops. Yeah. So. And then we've got really two dimensions to consider, yeah, in constructing it, whether we approach the integration incrementally or whether we adopt a non-incremental strategy. And if we adopt an incremental strategy, should we go bottom-up or top-down? So basically, if we adopt a non-incremental strategy, then we slam the stuff together and we try and observe how the thing is interacting. Yeah. So what that would involve doing is saying, okay, we take the whole system, and then what we want to do is to observe, yeah, where interactions are happening, what interactions are happening, and whether they're correct. Mm-hmm. And that's the approach that we would take non-incrementally. If we look at incremental thing, then that depends a little bit on our development methodology. So if you take a top-down approach, or you take a bottom-up approach. And that depends quite a lot on the class of system that you're thinking about. Because if you're thinking about producing, let's say, a framework or an operating system or something which is actually providing a bunch of services, then typically what you do is you build it bottom up. Because you say, you know, because it's a bit like communication protocol or something like that. You say, we need the service underneath, and then we need the next level of service, and then the next level of service. And things kind of fit into layers. Yeah, they don't always fit into layers, but there's that kind of layered element to it. Whereas in other situations where we're interested in a particular piece of functionality, then something like a top-down approach is usually better, because we're saying, okay, I want it to behave this way, and then what you do is develop a top-down methodology where you say, okay, well, how do I split this up into sub-problems? And both are valid, but it depends a little bit on what you're trying to do. I mean, in the robot, I guess if you look at the communication kind of functionality, it's kind of layery kind of thing. Whereas if you look at something like the planning, yeah, then you've got a bunch of inputs, and then you want to develop what the plan will be. Yeah. So in there, that's a bit more top-down in the way that it's doing. So it'll depend on the components that you're looking at. So non-incremental testing, you might require the creation of more scaffolding. So if we test incrementally, non-incremental testing might require the creation of more scaffolding. In particular, if we test incrementally bottom up, we require fewer stub programs. Incremental testing reveals errors and misunderstandings across interfaces earlier than non-incremental approaches. Incremental testing should lead to earlier identification of problems and easier debugging. And incremental testing should be more thorough, since each increment fully tests some behavioral specification of a subcomponent. Non-incremental testing may make more effective use of test effort since it focuses on the system behavior. A non-incremental test might encourage more concurrency in doing the testing because you can just run lots and lots and lots of stuff. Whereas if you're building up, yeah, then you probably have to spread your testing effort over more time because you have to build more scaffolding. You have to and you have to look at the results of the previous one, do the fixes before you go on. So non-incremental basically means just taking the whole thing and testing it. Yeah. Okay. And then top-down versus bottom-up incremental test, and the choice is dependent on the particular structure and the architecture. So layered architectures work better bottom-up. Top-down is, you know, where you're intending to be sort of generic, yeah, so the components and product lines, so things that provide a particular piece of service. And top-down test commences with a top module in the system and then tests in layers descending through the dependency graph. And what that requires then is successive layers of stub modules that provide the smoke and mirrors that you need for the stuff at the top to work. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's always an issue because actually you don't get the full functionality, so you don't necessarily see everything that you're expecting to look at. But at least what you see is the demands that are being made on the stub modules, so you know whether that layer is sensible or not. So the complexity of stub modules is definitely an issue, and they can be quite simple, just indicating a particular method or procedure calls taking place, but may not be adequate for later rounds of testing. Yeah, so you can do things like replay results from a file. Yeah, eventually the stubs get replaced by the real module because you've developed them, and then you might want to check that with the real module the behavior is similar or the same as the thing where you've got the stubs, because you might want to verify that your stubs are working correctly. And as the stubs become more deeply embedded in the system, determining their behavior becomes increasingly difficult because as you go lower down, then it's harder to understand what demands are going to be made on the stubs by the surrounding environment. And deciding the balance between different increments is difficult. So do we want a stub just to check if a module's used in the expected manner? So here's the sequence. We start off, here's our test framework. We have the class under test. We have a couple of stub classes. Then class A is already tested. We do some integration and replace the stub class by class C. Yeah, we do some integration and replace class B, but we need to generate another stub here, yeah, in order to be able to test class B. And then finally, we end up with the full system, and we have to do some more integration testing to check that the relationship between B and D is correct. But if you look, if predominantly you're thinking about the demand coming on the class from above, and then calling on services from underneath, then this is quite a sensible way of going about doing things, yeah, because each time you do a new piece of integration, then what you do is you expose this class to the demands that are going to be made on it by the environment that's being used in. Mm-hmm. So it's not a bad way of doing things. The advantages, major defects are more likely at top level modules. So if that's the case, then top down is beneficial because you see the errors early on. And actually, if you think about it, the top level modules in the system are typically things that are closely related to the requirement. Yeah. So if you see that there's actually a failure to understand the requirement, typically that'll come out in the top level module somewhere. Not always. I mean, it can be that there's some terrible misunderstanding that propagates right down to the very bottom level in the system. Yeah, getting some I/O functions in early can ease test case writing, yeah, and then early demonstration of the main functionality can be helpful in highlighting requirements problems. Too much effort on the stubs, too complex,
difficult to define, impossible to accurately reproduce test conditions. Some observations may be impossible to make. I'll come back to that in a minute. And then it encourages the idea that test and development can overlap, and it can't. It isn't necessarily a good idea. And then it encourages deferring full testing of modules until the lower level modules are complete, because it's such a hassle to produce stubs, yeah, that people just leave it until they've got the lower down stuff. This one, I think, is quite interesting. I mean, programming languages, as you know, I mean, particularly object-oriented programming languages, go to great lengths to make sure that you can't see certain values. Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, you're encouraged to use private values quite a lot of the time. Most objects have got quite a lot of internal state that, again, you don't necessarily see. But from a testing perspective, you would really, really, really like to know what the private variables are set to after you've run your system for a while. Yeah. So there's various ways that you can do that. For example, you can put in observation functions that let you observe those private values. Yeah. So you can actually, so you add extra functionality to let you access them. So that's one way of doing it. Another way of doing it that people quite often do is actually to develop a whole different version where all the privates are changed to public. Yeah, so you can pick up and see the thing. So if you like, there's a transparent version of the program where you can see all the public, you can see all the private variables, and then there's the version of the program that you're actually going to release on the world where everything that's the things that you want to be private are private. So there's the possibility of working on two different versions in order that you can make these observations. The other way that observations are complete, that observations are difficult to make is if there's any kind of concurrency in your system. Yeah. Because it may be completely, if you have multiple threads in your program, it may be completely impossible to reconstruct the sequence of accesses that you've had to shared variables across the threads. And so making any kind of observation in that context can be very difficult to do. Bottom-up testing, so here you start with a bunch of stuff at the bottom and then you basically build up. You initiate testing with unit tests for the bottom modules, and then candidates for inclusion in the next batch of tests depend on the dependency structure, and a module's included if all the modules that depend on it have been tested. Yeah, so there's issues about circularity, how you break things, where you start, and so on. And you may need to consider connected components where you have circles. Yeah. And prioritization of modules for inclusion should include their criticality for correct operation. So here you get this kind of thing where you have a test framework, you test class D, and then you stick B on top of it. You do your integration test around here, then you test class C in its test framework. Actually, each of these test frameworks is going to be different, yeah, because the interface has to be different apart from anything else. And then you've got C, then you do the integration of this component and this component into here, and then you have your test framework here. And if you notice, there are no stubs. Yeah. Of course, in practice, there may be circular dependencies here, in which case you'll have to break it and produce a stub in order to be able to test the thing. So, I think we're nearly there. So bottom-up testing is helpful if errors are likely to be deep down in the dependency structure. Test conditions are easier to create. An observation of test results is reasonably easy because you're, in a sense, you're inside the abstraction boundaries quite a lot of the time because you're looking at the low-level things to begin with. And you've got reduced effort in producing stub modules. You need to create driver modules, but arguably that's easier. And tools like JUnit make it easier. And the entire system is subjected to the smallest amount of test, yeah, because the top modules are included in last. Yeah, so if you like, the stuff you've exposed to fewest tests is the stuff at the top. And if that's something that's doing critical things for you, then you don't necessarily want to have that. And it's clear that you can use hybrid strategies, so you can use a bit of bottom-up and a bit of top-down. Yeah. And there, what you do is you use other criteria. So you will use things like criticality, so you decide on the groups of modules that provide the most critical functionality, and you choose to integrate them first, because they get subjected to most tests. The ultimate... I actually talked to a guy about this at one point. It was the guy who he designed. In the US, they have a different approach to standards for some things. So quite often, they'll have a competition. They'll just say, OK, we need a new bus for avionics. And they go to five or six companies and say, the spec is that it looks like this. You produce one, and then we'll go with your one, and that'll be the industry standard. And you get the benefit, you know, because you've won, you get the benefit of producing it. Yeah, and all your competitors will have to try and catch up and then compete with you in that area. Yeah, it's very neat. Produces quite clean standards. Very different from Europe, where you'll have a committee of, you know, 16,000 people kind of debating over, you know, the very, you know, whether there's a comma in this sentence or not, yeah, in order that everybody can compete on a level playing field, you know, and you get these Baroque standards come out. So it's a very different environment. But I was talking to one of these guys about how they decided how much test they needed to do on the safety critical bus. And he said, well, we tested it and tested it and tested it, and before the money ran out, we didn't find any more errors for a long time. And then we waited until we ran out of money, and there were no errors coming for the last month of testing. So we decided it was okay. Yeah. So, I mean, that's been used, and it's a perfectly good bus. In fact, it works very, very effectively. But ultimately, cost is the most critical thing, and maybe I should have made more of this in your software testing practical. That coming in on cost would have been a good idea. Yeah, would have been something. Maybe I'll make more emphasis on that next year, where cost is the number of hours that you've spent working on it. Yeah, because time is money. And then there's a question about adequacy criteria. Are we out of time? We are, aren't we? Yeah. Okay, so I'll finish this off. There's not much more to go. But here, this is talking about how do we measure when we've done enough integration testing. So again, it's talking about adequacy criteria. But I'll talk to you about that next time. Okay, thanks a lot. Hello. Yeah, we do. I'm going to mail you. Yeah, don't worry. I'll do that.
What am I supposed to do?
You're supposed to send me an outline of your thing. An outline of your topic. One page. Yeah? Yeah. Just like the ones that we looked at last time. Yeah? And then that'll be fine.